Support for Living on Earth comes from listeners like you. Please make a donation online at loe.org or call me at 617-629-3638. And thanks.
Old Greenland is a dreadful place. It's a land that's never green. There's ice and snow, and the whale fishes grow, and daylight's seldom seen, brave boys.
Well, according to that old sea shanty, Greenland is a dreadful place. It's a land that's never green, where there's ice and snow, and the whale fishes blow, and the daylight's seldom seen. Not exactly vacation land, but we caught up with a researcher from the UK's Cambridge University as he was packing for a year-long stay in Greenland. Stephen Pax-Leonard is an anthropological linguist, and for the next year, he'll be in one of the northernmost settlements on Earth. He'll live with the Inuit, subsistence hunters in northwest Greenland, learn their language, and document their culture as they and Greenland head for big changes. Dr. Stephen Pax-Leonard joins us from Cambridge. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us about the Inuit, how they live, and what's compelling you to visit.
Well, this is one of the last hunter-gatherer societies left in Greenland. And although these people live in the remote northwest corner of Greenland, they really represent the cultural center in the sense that there's a tradition of storytelling, which is really goes back to the basis of Greenlandic culture and narrative. The reason why I'm going, there are two reasons, really, in fact. First of all, is to document their language, which is called Inuktitut, and second, to record, digitize, archive, and ultimately give back to the community a collection of stories and narratives which tell us about this extraordinary Arctic society's history and identity.
Do they have a written form of their language?
They don't, no. Standard West Greenlandic is a written language, but Inuktitut has never been written down. It's not an Indo-European language. This language belongs to the Eskimo-Aleut family. It's what linguists call an agglutinative language, which means it's lots of different sort of affixes glued together. So if you take, for example, the phrase, otherwise I had planned on going to school, you would have to say, adua fim muk nia aluapanga. That is one long word, believe it or not. A whole sentence in English is one long word. And to break that down, adua is the word for school, fim is the word for building, mukka is the affix to go to, niar is the affix to intend to, aluar is the affix otherwise, and then punga at the end is sort of the first person singular, the I. It's a completely different way of looking at language, which makes it so very difficult.
I know that in most societies that depend on an oral tradition, it's powerful in that it goes back a long way, but it's fragile in that it depends on the generational link. What's the threat to this generation link for this oral tradition?
This community, this way of life, this culture is all threatened because actually of global warming. As I say, this is a hunter-gatherer society, and it's a society that's really very dependent on the hunting of sea mammals. Global warming and very dramatic climate change in this corner of Greenland is leading to sort of fewer animals being in the sea to kill in the first place, but it's also making the hunting of these animals extremely difficult and dangerous. And the reason for that is this community insists on using very traditional methods. They hunt in kayaks, they use harpoons, and they use dog sleds. And so really, this entire way of life is threatened. And there's now, this community is under political pressure to move slightly further south. And if that happens, I think ultimately this community will fragment, and then the language will be lost, the culture will be lost, and this history of storytelling will go as well, I think.
We read just a few weeks ago in the news of an enormous chunk of ice breaking off of Greenland. Give us a sense of the rate of change that these people are dealing with.
The people that I've been speaking to in this community, they are telling me that climate change is happening far faster than any of them believed was possible. That vast iceberg that you refer to is very close to this community where I'm going. It's actually slightly further up the coast in an uninhabited region of Greenland. The community is telling me that their entire way of life, their culture, will simply not be there in 10 to 15 years' time. And that's a problem for them, but it's also a problem for the Greenlandic government, because if they are no longer able to survive by hunting sea mammals and so on and so forth, then the Greenlandic government is sort of obliged to provide welfare, medical benefits, social benefits and so on to this community, and that's hugely expensive because it's so very remote.
So that's the political pressure for them to move?
That's the political pressure, and there's great tension in the community because the people don't want to leave. This is the place where their ancestors have lived for hundreds of years. And the alternative, you know, if they to leave this community, they'll probably end up being housed in modern flats in the capital in Nuuk, which is 1,500 miles away. They'll live a completely different life. And within no time at all, their language would be gone because it's only spoken by 1,000 people.
And how do you prepare for a trip like this? A year in a pretty hostile environment, one where I'm guessing a good chunk of the year is going to be in complete darkness.
That's correct. There are enormous number of challenges. The average temperature in the winter is minus 25 degrees Celsius, which means it falls to about minus 40 degrees Celsius, which I think is more or less the same in Fahrenheit at that point. The sun goes down for the last time on the 24th of October and doesn't rise again until the 8th of March. That's 3.5 months of darkness. That's probably going to be difficult to deal with. But I think perhaps the biggest challenge, personal challenge, will probably be the diet. There's only one ship of fruit and vegetables that goes this place a year. So I will be eating seals, whales, narwhals, walruses, just as this community does. And that's not something I've done before, so that's, I'm sure, going to be quite a shock to the system as well.
And how are your whaling skills? Are you going to be a useful person up there?
Not initially, no. I'm going to be an impediment initially, I'm sure. But I very much need to learn to live the way they live. And the reason for that is a lot of these, this tradition of storytelling, these stories and narratives and myths and Inuit drum songs, they are often performed on hunting expeditions, actually. And so I obviously need to be part of that, and I need to make myself as useful as possible on those hunting trips as soon as possible.
It sounds like an amazing adventure and opportunity, but it also sounds like it's going to be tinged with a great deal of sadness, knowing that what you're documenting is, in all likelihood, a way of life that's nearing an end.
Yes, I think so. Obviously, I can't stop global warming, and there's not much I can do to really sort of save some of these traditions, really. But what I can do is go there and I can record this material, I can digitize it and archive it. But more importantly, what I would like to do is actually give it back to the community and publish it in their language, in Inuktitut, which has, of course, not been done before. Previously, what people have done is they've collected some of this material, and it's normally been published in Danish, and it's not really been made very accessible to these people. So it'd be great to give that back to this community. And even if this way of life does disappear in 10 or 15 years, as people are telling me, then at least we'll have some record of this extraordinary culture.
Stephen Pax Leonard, an anthropological linguist from the University of Cambridge, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Bascom, Eileen Bolinski, Bruce Gellerman, Ingrid Lobet, Helen Palmer, Jessica Elise Smith, Ike Sriskanjaraja, and Mitra Taj, with help from Sarah Calkins and Sammy Sousa. And this week, we welcome our new interns, Nora Doyle Burr and Hona Lyles. Audio of protesters in our piece from New Orleans provided by the documentary A Village Called Versailles, which aired on PBS's Independent Lens in May 2010. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Lirish-Dean composed our themes. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. And you can find us anytime at loe.org. And check out our Facebook page. It's PRI's Living on Earth. I'm Jeff Young. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science. And Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners. The Ford Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of climate change and marine issues. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve a chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And Pax World Mutual Funds, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making. On the web at paxworld.com. Pax World, for tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.